Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome back to the Train a Happy podcast with me, Tally Rye. This is the podcast that helps you have a feel-good relationship with fitness, food, and body image. And today, I'm very excited for this episode. We are chatting to Dr. Brendan Stubbs, who is one of the top 1% highest cited researchers in the world. He's written over 700 academic papers, and he specializes in the links between exercise and mental health. I absolutely loved chatting to Brendan in this episode. We learned so much about how movement impacts our brain, impacts our mental health, and how focusing on weight and aesthetics is really short-sighted when it comes to exercise and movement and really sells it short. So I think you're going to take a lot of encouragement from this episode. But of course, before we get into that, it is time for Train Happy Trooper of the Week. Now, I'm nominating myself for Train Happy Trooper of the Week this week because I just had the most amazing workout class this morning. I was fortunate enough to go to a brand event and they chose to do it at Frame in London. And it was a dance cardio event with a guy called Chris. I'm shouting him out specifically because if you live in London and you get the opportunity to do his class, I think you're just going to have the best time. Because truly, the energy he brought to the room, the moves, the music, it just really lined up to just be everything I love personally in a kind of dance workout. And it just made me feel so good. I chat about this in this episode with Brendan because I wanted to know like what was going on in my brain in that moment. I have felt so great during and after, and it really has just energized me for the day, and I just feel amazing. So if you're thinking, you know, oh, dancing doesn't count enough as cardio. Cardio has to be on a machine, you know, in the gym, or it has to be running, or it has to be really vigorous. You know, you can do so many things, fun things to raise your heart rate, and I just really recommend this class as one of them. Now, if you have a train happy moment to share, then we of course want to hear from you. So please, you can share it like me, you can WhatsApp us, you can send us a voice note or a text. We do love a voice note. Send it into 075-999-27537. And if you are international, please put a +44 in front of that. And we would love to hear from you. But enough from me. Let's get into this week's episode with the brilliant Dr. Brendan Stubbs. Dr. Brendan Stubbs, welcome to the podcast. We've been trying to make this happen for a while. Thank you so much for coming in. We really appreciate it.
I appreciate it, and I'm so pleased to be here. Really looking forward to talking to you.
I'm really looking forward to talking to you because even in our like little chat, we've already had several moments where we've gone, no, save it for the podcast, save it for when we're recording. Because this episode, I really want it to be just a great reminder for people of all the incredible benefits of exercise that have nothing to do with weight or appearance, because that is what traditional marketing is always focused on, and yet I feel is really holding people back from finding kind of a long-term reason to move their bodies. And I have a feeling that's we're kind of aligned in our thinking, and I'm sure you've got a ton of research and evidence to hopefully back up my claims. But before we get into it, I think it would just be really interesting to hear how you came to become such a prolific researcher in the space of exercise and mental health. It's like, is it about 700 studies you've
It is, yeah. I had a misspent decade of my life where I got a bit involved in research and with a great group of people, and we were really passionate and enthusiastic about it, and we just kind of got a bit carried away. So I think we've really realised that we probably know enough now. Now it's really important to talk about this so everybody can hear about what does the evidence say and really implement it. That's why I'm so passionate about, you know, joining people like yourself and your audience to talk about all of what we know.
But my friend is now engaged to a scientist, and he's hoping to get, you know, probably his first big paper published. And you've done 700. I think people don't actually quite appreciate how incredible that feat is. Not many people have done 700 papers.
No, not many, and very esteemed professors who've been there for many decades haven't done that many. So by metrics, boring metrics, it does put me in a very high percentile of the sort of top researchers of all disciplines. Yeah, it's not a feat I'm massively proud of, but yeah,
you
we've made.
Be.
I
you
know,
be.
But yeah, I really want to get the message out now. So we've done a lot, and it adds to the credibility, right?
Yeah.
So I guess it kind of says I know a bit what I'm talking mm-hmm. about.
You've done a lot of stuff. I think I saw something where you said I've read over 10,000 papers. You know, this is your bread and butter. I would love to know how you even came to specialise in this area.
It's a number of sort of really fortunate circumstances that were really beyond my control. So I came into mental health and focusing in mental health 20 years ago. And it was after graduating, so did physiotherapy first. And I was a bit like, not really feeling a lot of the areas, and then I finished like my degree and I wanted to go home back to my parents, and my mum was sort of like looking at her clerk and saying, come on Brendan, you know, get a job or do something. And she worked in a mental health hospital at that time, and she knew the head of physiotherapy. She's like, go in and have a chat. So before I knew it, I was having like an informal interview with the head of physiotherapy, and she just said, do you want to come and work in? It was very unusual for physiotherapists to do that at that time, and all of my friends were like, why are you going to work in a mental health hospital? Because obviously stigma was not what it is now. People just like
everything like padded cells.
Yeah,
kind of
padded
vibe.
Cells. Are you going to be safe? Are you going to be safe? All of that stigmatizing stuff. And I loved it. You know, I just loved it. The people were fascinating. You know, really rewarding, and people so receptive. And I just saw such huge potential to make a difference. And I fell in love with mental health and mental illness from there on in, really. And it's just been a wonderful journey of exploration ever since. And it's always people who teach me the most. People that have inspired me with different mental health conditions or symptoms or problems, and they're the people that have led me to go on to try and find and understand and do things better because of the sort of struggles and things that we've done with them. So that's kind of how I got into it, and just got really carried and excited away, you know, along the way, and kind of here I am now, you know, a little bit down the line, a bit more experience, and kind of got into research again, a bit of an accident, and again sort of reluctantly fell in love with it. And I think when I did my first degree, I was like, I hate studying. I'm never doing anything academic ever again. And all of my university friends were like, you were the, you know, person we expected to be the least most like a scientist. And they're all like flabbergasted when they see anything that I do. So, you know, it's just strange how life works. And I've just loved it ever since, really. And I'm very privileged. I've got, you know, an amazing job. I love what I do. I'm just passionate about all of it. And it's great to be able to talk to you about it.
I can imagine at the beginning of your career, this was quite an under-researched area when it came to mental health, thinking about, I presume, sort of lifestyle factors that can contribute to improving people's mental health, because it has been, I presume, so stigmatized and not thought about necessarily. But I feel, you know, now we're getting headline after headline. And I know recently there's been quite a bit in the news about, you know, this can, you know, if we exercise more, it can help reduce depression and all the rest of this. But you know, you had the foresight to go there. How have you seen this field evolve since you started?
Yeah, well, it's been privileged to be part and to sort of witness this previously. So I think public attitudes have changed towards mental health and mental illness massively, because there wasn't many people really openly talking about their experiences. Now we've got quite a lot of high profile people, and that really sort of kind of helps to change public attitudes. You know, someone coming out and talking about depression or not wanting to carry on, and you know, or you know, at the other end of the spectrum, schizophrenia, maybe hearing voices, for instance, or having bipolar disorder and having these, you know, great highs or lows. You know, we just didn't have that. And so that's really helped sort of, you know, raise awareness that this affects all of us. There's nothing to stop, you know, me when I leave here today having a psychotic episode. It could be me. It could be me tomorrow. It could be, you know, you listening, and you know, it may be you. And I think that's really helped sort of raise awareness that we're all in this. And just like physical health, we've all got mental health. And just like our physical health changes and we get unwell physically, mental health does not discriminate. It can also, you know, impact any of us too. So huge changes in sort of public perception. That's been massive to sort of openness and awareness in the area. And in terms of like the research and interest, the research previously was really wishy-washy and quite crap, to be honest. So it wasn't very good. So a lot of people working in the field, like psychiatrists, doctors, just and rightly so, didn't really believe the evidence of physical activity, exercise, what we eat, you know, the importance of sleep could really influence our mental health. And we had to do some like really obvious studies just to demonstrate, you know, quite the obvious, to get people on side, say, well, actually some really credible evidence for that. So science has really caught up with what we've known for quite a long period of time. And that's changed attitudes in sort of scientists, policy makers, not this wishy-washy subject, which it once was. And, you know, previously, mind and body were, you know, considered quite separately, very much a focus on the body. And since the, you know, loads of evidence has come out to show that we can't, you know, just consider, you know, below the neck as being important. And, you know, much with the mental health services, for instance, you know, we're really prioritizing looking after people's physical health and vice versa in physical health hospitals. So huge changes in the care of people more generally, and also health promotion efforts. You know, it's not wishy-washy to say that, you know, eating right, you know, eating, you know, better or moving more is good for your mental health. This is not wishy-washy science or something, you know, a wish list. This is actually based on really good evidence. So looking forward to unpicking some with you today.
Yes, lived experience tells us that movement does make us feel better. I mean, today I've come to this recording, I've just been at an event, I did this kind of dance cardio class this morning, and I've never had more fun exercising. And I was beaming like halfway through the class. I just felt so great. And I think it's probably the combination of a bit of sunshine finally. It feels like winter is ending and we're going into spring, and this real combination of things. And I finished that feeling like, oh, this kind of, I've been carrying around maybe a bit of an anxious cloud the last few months, and it just feels like it's really lifting for me, and I'm like, wow, I feel great. And so I mentioned to you that I had kind of heard that it's not all endorphins, and actually endorphins are a bit of a myth, and I thought maybe you could expand on that. What was going on for me when I was doing that kind of dance class? Like, what's going on in my brain? How is that impacting my mood and my overall mental well-being?
Yeah, absolutely. So when you commonly like talk to people, and I mentioned earlier that just I was in another meeting saying it's just due to endorphins, isn't it? But you know, it's so much more complicated than that, and so much more beautiful in many ways. And when we move and we're breathing more and our heart's going and we're working our muscles, you know, having this multi-system, so numerous systems within the body are working, the mind and the brain. And also, you know, we're feeling good if we're doing something we enjoy, which you talked about, right? You're having fun. I mean, that just really changes everything. You know, with endorphins, what I'll say briefly before I touch upon what's going on is we actually realize that endorphins have difficulty crossing what's known as the blood-brain barrier. So to exert an effect within the brain is, you know, they need to cross that threshold to exert an effect. And they are released when they exercise, but it's not easy for them to cross over, and they need to combine with, you know, another molecule which is related to sort of pleasure systems and pain too. And that's not always so easy. So it's not purely due to endorphins, and just naming it due to one molecule is really reductionist, and it's not doing, you know, the joys which you spoke about, you know, anywhere near enough justice. So what do we know? So we know lots is going on. I said multi-systems happening. So whenever we move and talk, and whenever we do anything, we're getting electrical activity in our brain. So specifically when we move and engage in and heart rate activity, we're getting like areas that are lighting up within the brain immediately. So like the hippocampus is one area that's often talked about. I've spoke about this quite a lot previously, and this is like an emotional processing area of the brain and helps with memory. And another area of the brain that we're really interested in is the prefrontal cortex. And again, this is really important, and this sort of lights up immediately. And you see this if you put people in scanners and they're doing like light functional magnetic resonance imaging scanners, and you get them to do light cycling. You can see this like lighting up of these key areas of the brain that are shut down when people are like depressed, anxious, and all these other things. So these like areas are lit up, you know, within 30 seconds. So you're getting this immediate release, and then you're getting lots of release of other chemicals within the brain or other hormones. So you're getting like growth peptides being released. You're getting other factors such as brain derived neurotrophic factor or BDNF, and this is like a fertilizer which helps sort of grow new cells within the brain or new areas within the brain and new connections within the brain. Because larger areas in the brain means that that area is being strengthened and increased, because the brain's always changing and really sort of making and modeling itself, and you get new connections between key areas of the brain. So like areas between hippocampus and prefrontal cortex, the more you use those areas, the more you're sort of building up the size of those, and the more you're getting connections between those and other areas of the brain. So that sort of, you know, helps that. And then you're getting sort of release of, you know, anti-inflammatory, you know, markers too, and inflammation's been implicated as possibly being related to the onset of some mental health conditions too, such as depression, anxiety. And you're just getting this release of these substances too, such as C-reactive protein and some interleukins too. And then you're getting other sort of neurochemical factors as well. You're getting release of like dopamine, this like reward chemical that's released within you. You're getting serotonin released as well. You know, and I'm just naming, you know, maybe 10% of different molecules that are getting released. And all of these are, you know, going around and, you know, concocting themselves together and having this synergistic and big effect on your mental health. And I've just really talked about what's going on in the brain and the bloodstream around the brain at the moment. And, you know, also if we talk about like the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system and how, you know, our breathing sort of changes when we engage in exercise and you get regulation within the nervous system, this also plays an important role too. And, you know, and then if we look at like the biopsychosocial mechanisms, you know, what's going on in our social, you know, setting and how we're feeling about ourselves, is you feel a sense of self-esteem if you do something, if you're having fun, you know, it just feels much less effort to sort of do what you're doing. It takes off your mind from the sort of task of, you know, perhaps working hard, and you may be able to sort of work harder. So lots is going on, and it's a bit reductionist just to say it's just due to one hormone or chemical, which probably, you know, doesn't exert, you know, substantial effect.
How do we get people to realize that there's so much going on in your brain, and your body and brain are benefiting so much? Because I think if people knew that, and this is why I wanted to have this conversation, and, you know, why I'll keep banging the drum of all these benefits of movement, is because I feel like that feels like a very much more clear benefit. And it really goes to show, I mean, it's not so sexy to say like, I'm reducing my risk of depression, and I am, you know, anti-inflammatory properties are released in my brain. Like, that doesn't sound sexy, and yet this is really important stuff for not only right now but as we age, right?
Quite.
And I presume there's also links there with developing like Alzheimer's and dementia, which are, I believe, like some of the biggest killers in the UK, actually.
Yeah.
And these are all the things that we can do, like right now, today. I did it this morning, and
protect our brain. So we get the immediate effect, which you described, and then we get the longer term effect. And we know that, you know, the more you do these activities, the more active you are, that it can help reduce your risk of depression in the future. We've shown anxiety, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder as well, in terms of reducing the risk. You know, and also dementia, as you said, and these all sort of add up to help keep us healthy. And we've not even really talked about the physical health benefits as well, which we know as well, in terms of like, I don't know, your risk of diabetes in the future. And this can really sort of help. And again, I'm not saying this is the solution, the only thing.
Well,
but
this was
part of,
have this question, because I think this is where maybe there's not a lot of place for nuance in headlines, is there?
No.
And we see a lot of discussion around the mental health benefits of exercise. And for example, I think you were part of a study recently, and they're saying like, you can, you know, exercise is just as good as medication for treating depression, as an example. I think the kind of media sometimes kind of likes to all go in on one thing. So it can't be both true that medication and exercise are, you know, both important for different people in different contexts, and, you know, but we like to go like, well, it's just exercise. And so it kind of lacks that nuance. Do you get frustrated sometimes thinking, okay, this is really exciting, and also let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater?
Yeah, quite. And you've got this sort of, you know, difficult scenario where, as researchers, as wearing my research hat, we're naturally quite reserved. We don't like to make big statements. We like to be cautious. We like to heavily caveat things. And that's pretty boring headlines.
Yeah.
So you go to like, a press release or something. It's just boring when you add all of that in. So we've really got to carefully caveat all everything that we're coming out with, because no research into anything is ever perfect. And there's always caveats. But it's really with this sort of, overarching amount of evidence, which, we're sort of, very confident in. And I think there's a few sort of false and unfortunate dichotomies where we're saying, this is as good as X or Y. And we kind of had to do that to sort of try and get some equivalence and sort of some credibility within it. I think as researchers, we've got a responsibility also to be really careful about how we communicate research too. So I'll give you an example about exercise and depression recently. So there was two papers that came out recently. So there was a big paper and I wasn't involved in either, but they're both great. So one was in the British Journal of Sports Medicine, and these authors looked at 97 reviews. So reviews of previously published literature of exercise, and say, does it help for depression and anxiety and, the general population, so people without conditions or HIV, cancer and lots of other things. And really good, really robust. And they found, unsurprisingly, like lots of other stuff has done, that it does help when you have exercise as an intervention. But the headline which came out, and I'm not sure if it's the press release or the media, was, exercise is 1.5 times more effective than medication. And they didn't look at that question. So they didn't look, they didn't compare exercise versus medication. So, in order to have that statement, you've really got to compare those two things together. And it's just not a helpful narrative to have, because, like you said, some people respond to medication at different times, and some people really need it, and some people respond to exercise at other times. And why not? If I was struggling today, I would have both, and I'd have anything that I needed to get well as such. So we don't want to sort of alienate any option, because it's all important for all of us, as is talking therapists and everything else too. So this was just a really and it just of course, because the headline just spread like everywhere, and I'm just seeing it everywhere, 1.5 times more. But they didn't look at that, and it's just a dishonest headline. It's not true. And unfortunately, from a research perspective, there was a really, really good study in the Netherlands which actually looked at this question. It's a really important question to look at, but just to sort of place context on how good is running, they looked at running 2 or 3 times a week over 16 weeks in what we call a randomized controlled trial. And this is where you randomize people to, one intervention or another. So it reduces the risk of bias, and it's very sort of credible from a research perspective. And what they did in this study in the Netherlands, about 160 people from memory, is people were allocated to the running group or the antidepressant group for their first treatment for depression. And what they found is in this, that exercise and medication were just as good for treating mental health symptoms. Fantastic. So they both worked just as well as each other, but the exercise was better also for your physical health. And that's a really novel study, because nobody has really directly compared these head-to-head previously, showing that they both work. And that's probably the truth, is they're both just as good as each other in these mild to moderate cases of depression, not the other headline, which is just a bit misleading.
Yeah, because medication is life-saving for some people.
Quite.
But so can movement be in some instances. Quite. So it's, it's like, let's have many ingredients in the pie.
Yeah.
Interesting you mentioned like talking therapy as well, because I think there's this statement in the fitness industry that really winds me up, that is like, exercise is therapy. And I find it really frustrating, because I think that gives people, it feels like a permission slip to only exercise. And I think when we do that, it leads down a slippery slope of developing potentially really disordered relationship with exercise, because we over rely on one thing and we don't feel like we've got anything else in our toolkit. But what I'm hearing from you is that we actually need multiple tools, and it's really dependent on the person.
It's really dependent on the point in time. And I would recommend you get what's best for you, and that may include a combination of all of those, maybe at the same time, maybe at different times. I mean, they all fundamentally serve to make you feel better and have a good experience, but they all do different things, really. I mean, talking therapies, is a specialist psychological therapy with a trained person who is guiding you through a process and processing things and helping you make decisions and lots of other things. That's very different from engaging in exercise. And over reliance on any one thing is not very good. And we want to help people to have a in the context of exercise, a positive relationship with this. We're not where it's sort of almost becoming like a, I don't really like the word, but like a crutch. I can't think of anything else on the time. You know, it's there to be enjoyed and to be positive. And, you know, if you are dealing with issues and you are dealing with low mood, and you know, we need to talk about some of these with a trained professional person who can help us overcome those. And I think that we really need to acknowledge there's a place for everything in here. And if you need help, go and, you know, get the appropriate help.
I like that in that study as well that you mentioned, where it was comparing medication and exercise, that in that they're asking people to move 2 to 3 times a week, which I think feels, you know, I know at a point in time for me that was like, that's not enough, because you got to do it 5-6 times a week for it to count. I think it's actually nice to show that even the research is looking at realistic goals for people, rather than that this idea that we have to be complete gym bunnies or we have to be doing something every day, that there's this idea that finding some space in your life, but not too much space, but consistently is more important. Is it, do you feel that consistency is greater than necessarily quantity within a week, say?
Absolutely. And, you know, particularly if you think about depression and low mood, you know, if you sort of said to me, you know, and I was really depressed and anxious, you know, you've got to go and exercise 5 or 6 times a week, I'd be like, I can't do that.
Can't even get out of bed.
Yeah, I can't even get out of bed. You know, I've worked with many people and know many people in my own life who that's just impossible. So it's really important to meet people where they are. And, you know, getting started is just really important for some people, and just, you know, experience some success. Because if we don't experience some success early on, then we're just not going to get started, not going to sort of initiate and the physical activity, and we're not going to, you know, carry on with that. So, you know, it's important early on when we're working with people with depression, anxiety, we're not feeling great, just getting out and doing something is really better than nothing. And once you get up and going and you've got your confidence and you've enjoyed it and you know you can do it, then, you know, more is better than some. But just get started really is really important. If we look at like guidelines or 150 minutes, these are, you know, moderate or vigorous physical activity. You know, these are for, you know, the general population. These are ideal targets, and most people don't meet these. And it's important that you realize you don't have to get there straight away. Some people may never get there, but it's a process of building up over time. And, you know, like with anything that's good for us, is we want to build a long-term, sustainable, enjoyable relationship. And why not go and have fun with your movement and go on a relationship with movement and fun, where you can, you know, really try different things and experience, you know, new sort of movement types and go and have fun, you know, with all of those things.
Well, it's Train Happy Podcast for a reason, Brendan. So when you're talking about some rather than nothing, and we're talking about physical activity, I think, like I said, and 150 minutes of physical activity, I think so many of us think that that does involve, right, I've got to go and do a boot camp class, or I've got to go and do whatever else. But it can be something like, physical activity is actually a broad term. Am I correct?
You are. So, yeah, the terms get used interchangeably, but sort of by, you know, boring research definition, physical activity generally means any bodily movement that increases your energy expenditure.
So my gardening yesterday, and I was sweeping my patio and I was doing my back in, that was...
Very much so, but be careful of your back. So that's it. You know, any, you know, movement, and then sort of, you know, exercise is specifically, you know, a subset of physical activity where we're setting out, you know, with the intention of improving our sort of fitness specifically. And many people have sort of difficult sort of, you know, connotations around the word exercise. If you've not had very positive experiences early on, it could just be
movement.
Yeah.
Because I think it's a neutral term. I think exercise, for some people I know, especially people I work with, because I really work with, you know, a group of people, and I think a lot of the listeners, we're quite sensitive to the word exercise because we probably had quite a negative experience with it. It felt like a chore, it felt very compulsive maybe. And using movement and physical activity, I think, feels so much more broader in general and takes the pressure off.
Yeah, and it's not loaded, right? Yes. I mean, particularly if you just, I don't know, if you think about like those difficult times like PE, and it was felt quite... Yeah.
If you weren't really good at sports, if you weren't feeling like you're naturally athletic, then you felt like there was no place for you.
And no wonder we're setting up people not to have a lifelong, you know, nice relationship with movement, which is to be enjoyed and go on your own journey with it.
Is there anything in the research where it's shown like different forms of movement? Maybe it's like more outdoor activities, or you know, I'm thinking of things like, I don't know, paddleboarding or rock climbing, or is there stuff to show that that there is a preference for a type of exercise or movement, should I say.
So we'll say a bit about intensity, so how hard we're working first, and then I'll talk a bit about the type of activity. So generally speaking, most guidelines are set up around, you know, moderate or vigorous intensity, and this is your heart rate working in a particular zone. And you know, moderate activities or movements could be where you're sort of starting to take some really quite deep breaths. I don't know, just sort of walking briskly, you know, doing a light dance or perhaps playing a bit of tennis, but you're still able to maintain a conversation. And vigorous is where you're, you know, really finding it quite difficult to maintain a conversation. And light has been really neglected, but there's also good benefits associated with light activities, such as gentle, you know, walking around or some gentle gardening, for instance. So those are all set up towards moderate and vigorous intensity activity. But the research shows that, you know, light activity is very beneficial for your mental and physical health, as is moderate and vigorous physical activity. And generally, you know, if people move along that continuum from intensity, you tend to see, you know, increased benefits. But the problem is, not many people like, you know, smashing it all of the time. And it's not sustainable. Quite.
I don't want to smash it every day.
No, I don't, because it's not sustainable. It's not enjoyable. So there's no point going up and saying, I'm going to go and hammer this, if you're not going to sort of feel good that day or the next day, and you don't want to do it and say, oh no, I've got to go out and, you know, smash it at all. So really, it's just about getting some in where you're just getting your heart rate up and you're working your muscles. And we know the importance of resistance exercise too, and that's reflected in guidelines. So all intensity movement is good, but the most important thing is do something which you're not going to be scared about going to do the next day, and you're going to go and have fun. And in terms of like type, so really type is basically they're all very helpful in terms of improving your mental health. So there's evidence around like Pilates, yoga. My friend's recently done a trial and sort of rock climbing.
Oh, cool.
As well. Yeah, Simon Rosenbaum, give him a shout out from Australia. So showing the benefits of that. Then we also know in terms of like resistance training work is also good. Running is good. So basically the key message is just find something you enjoy and go and have fun.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mum's the Word is a brand new parenting podcast hosted by me, Ashley James. Pregnancy, piles, and all the other problems that come with parenting, I'm not going to sugarcoat anything. Join me each week on my journey through motherhood as we celebrate the amazing highs as well as the lows. As it's my first time, we'll have celebrities, experts, and hopefully you guys too, who'll help me figure out what the hell I'm supposed to be doing. Find us wherever you got this podcast.
Something I do with my clients that I work in with intuitive movement is I get them to figure out a 0 to 10 effort scale, essentially. And we kind of work out what feels like comfortable, moderate, and hard on that 0 to 10. And we often realise that most people feel like for it to count, and I use air quotes for that, it has to be like a 7, 8, 9, 10. And that they have only historically really done a 7, 8, 9, 10. And we look at this whole scale, and I always say to them, I'm like, look, if you're going to have a consistent long-term relationship with movement, we need everything along the scale. And actually, you're going to find more consistency in probably a 0 to a 7 than you are in only doing 7, 8, 9, 10. So why don't we start there? And then you kind of bop up to that higher end of the scale, but only when you're ready, because that's how we build that consistency. And I really appreciate that you've essentially completely validated what I've said there.
There you go. It's great advice. I'll go further than that. So it's great advice.
Thank you. Thanks. I've got the stamp of approval. I know we mentioned depression in particular, but is there anything else that we really need to know about those sort of benefits for that? Because I know that that is, you know, one of the most talked about well-known kind of mental illnesses and one that people often suffer with in silence. And is there any kind of advice you have in A, what we know, and B, how those who maybe are listening who have experienced bouts of depression in their life can think about how movement can play a role going forward?
Yeah, so first of all, you know, I hope that you're not feeling alone, you know, if you are struggling today, and, you know, reach out to someone. And I think, you know, speaking from experience of helping people and being around people, I think, you know, if you are feeling, you know, struggling, is, it can feel like the hardest thing to do, but reach out to a friend, and it can just start off with a walk, you know, or something quite nice. It's often good to disguise any movement in terms of, you know, if you, maybe it's your friend that's struggling and you know that they're finding a difficult time, you say, come out for a walk, and then you're kind of like disguising the elements of you're going out for a bit of movement. You know, that person may be in isolation struggling, and we know that's common, and getting some fresh air, and all of these can help people. And again, we're starting with something quite light, because if you're in that space where you don't want to go out, you don't want to socialize, you know, getting up to a 7, 8, 9, 10, I mean, it's just, you're just not going to get started. So that's just really important when, you know, people are getting started, and just experience some success early on if you are struggling with depression is so key, because you can just feel that, you know, you're just never going to get over this, you can't do it, you can't do anything. And these are quite generic sort of statements that I've heard lots of. So you know, just experience some success, because you just feel everything's going against you when you're in that moment. So if you go out and do something positive and just sort of take the focus off necessarily about how you're feeling and everything, and it's just, it can be such a positive experience. So I think that's just really key for people going on, and not for all people, but that sense of social support is really key for, like, people, you know, who do and don't have depression, because we all like to feel we're part of something, whether it be a group of people with similar ideas, or a group of people doing sport, or someone, an accountability partner. And that's just so good to sort of bring people out of you know, how they may be feeling at a particular time, and it can help, you know, increase sort of commitment to sort of do something without too much pressure,
kind of relax it, and like it's a byproduct rather than the main focus.
Yeah, quite. And then you just sort of, you know, can go with it in terms of how you're going forward. So, you know, just say to those people in terms of starting, and just know that it can be a really important part of everybody. You know, if you do and don't have depression, of helping you feel better today, it can help, you know, as part of an overall lifestyle approach and everything else, to help you feel better in the longer term. And if you are struggling, it can be a really important part of helping you, you know, get on the road to recovery as part of other treatment approaches too.
I want to ask about exercise and ADHD, because ADHD is a big thing. I've had one of my very close friends diagnosed. I'm confident it's within the Rye family quite heavily. And I know that we mentioned earlier when we were talking about endorphins, we mentioned kind of dopamine and all that kind of stuff. We know that there is evidence, and I think thanks to social media, really, that a lot more people are aware of kind of traits of a neurodivergent brain and how movement can really play a role in supporting that and helping you kind of cope and manage. And so I was curious, from a selfish perspective, but I'm sure lots of people listening are probably having similar conversations with their friends and family, if they're anything like my friends and family, how can movement support those who may feel that they have ADHD?
Yeah, so there is, you know, good and emerging evidence that physical activity and movement can, you know, help people with ADHD. You know, so we've done, you know, research in younger people too, where we tend to see the onset, but there's a whole generation, lots of people who, you know, missed, you know, that recognition early on. And now we're seeing, as you know, mentioned, lots more people having this picked up later on in life, but that, you know, we're shown that it can help early on with people. And also in adults, there's good evidence that it can also improve people's ADHD symptoms and improve concentration, focus, particularly if you do like a, you know, a short bout of exercise, because it really sort of helps regulate the nervous system. And again, you know, ADHD is like a broad construct, but it helps sort of dial down the, you know, the excitement within the nervous system, which people can feel, particularly if we're living in like modern world and society where you may be sort of sitting still for excessive long periods of time, having to sort of listen for long periods of time, and find it difficult to sort of concentrate and focus. And breaking up your day with like snacks of movement or short bouts of exercise can really dial back in the concentration, the focus of people. And also what we can see with some people with ADHD is, you know, we call them like motor symptoms, and people get a bit fidgety. I get quite fidgety as well. And we tend to also see as like a dialing down of this too. And then people are able to sort of, you know, relax with their breathing, and breathing within this is very important too. So I think we've got much more to learn about this, and it's going to be an exciting journey. I think, again, something which can impact lots of people, but lots of people report when they engage in activity and movement, they just feel a sense of calmness and being able to go back and concentrate and do and feel better after.
Yeah, another topic for you to look at in the next 700 studies, I'm sure.
I'll hand the baton over now.
there's plenty of stuff we don't know, right? And there's always questions to be answered, I'm sure, that movement can play a role in just helping you kind of cope and manage and find, the headspace and the clarity and the focus. Is that to do with that hippocampus part of our brain?
And I think on this point and other points, I think it's good for scientists and people who communicate science, and I'm talking to myself here, is have a bit of humility around, we don't know most things. We're guessing at a lot of stuff. And we've got much more to learn from a science perspective. That doesn't mean we can't communicate this, but it means that we've just got to caveat it. And, anyone who sort of comes out and has a definitive answer for all things, we've just got to be a bit careful, really, I think, particularly when we're, new and emerging concepts like ADHD and also the brain. That's just one of my points, which is things careful to consider. I think when we're looking at the brain and what's happening, basically lots is happening when we engage in movement and exercise. But I think one of the sort of key areas that's really happening is we're getting a stimulation within the reward processing area of the brain, the limbic system, and also, sort of pain modulating systems too. So we get a sense of pain relief, which sounds a bit strange when we're engaging in exercise, but it's similar to some of like the opioid receptors which we have within the brain, or endocannabinoid receptors. And this sort of, brings this sense of relaxation, which we get from engaging in exercise. So after you've done a bout of physical activity or movement, and you feel a sense of, maybe it's 10 minutes after, 15 minutes, you feel like, I feel relaxed. And that's some of the key mechanisms, the stimulation of the endocannabinoid system, which people can feel after a bout of exercise. And that's really, attenuated or increased in people with ADHD and these other conditions where you get this excitation within the nervous system and the brain. You get this sense of almost release, like a valve's been let off, and people can just sort of relax, albeit temporarily, and just have a bit of clarity of thought.
And speaking of clarity of thought, one of the big projects you've been working on recently is with ASICS. It's been on the Mind Games. It's now a film on Amazon Prime. I was lucky enough to get invited to the premiere. Unfortunately, I've only seen half of it because I had to leave to get a train. But essentially, it's you and your team working with some of the kind of four sort of brightest minds in the world, who specifically focus on different sports, right? I think one was kind of gaming and like video gaming. Instead of me trying to remember, why don't we talk to the person who was part of it? Why don't you tell us, Brendan?
Of course. So this was such a privilege to be involved in. So we know that, more broadly, exercise is pretty good for our concentration and, our brain processing power. But we wanted to sort of look at two things within this Mind Games study. Is what happens when we look at people who are functioning from their mind perspective at a really high level. So it was a study including 77 sort of, national or international competitors within what we called Mind Games. So these were people who were playing competitively games such as chess or mahjong, which is a sport played particularly in Asia and Japan, speed Rubik's cubes, and people got immense concentration, or online e-gaming, for instance, or some other examples. And these were all competing at a really high level, and people who weren't at that time or for the 6 months prior regularly engaging in sort of physical activity. So what happens in this group? Very high functioning but not engaging in regular activity. And we put them through you know, a movement and exercise program, what happens to their, you know, concentration, their memory, their attention, their focus. And we looked at this sort of before and after 16 weeks. So it was over 20 countries, and there was four people followed in the film and their particular journeys. And it was just really amazing. We saw some really positive benefits in terms of improved concentration, memory, focus. When we tested these in terms of objective assessments, we got people to do tests, and we were, you know, watching them live, and then also in terms of how people reported they were feeling, and people did fitness tests and their fitness also improved, and it was just, you know, amazing. And people have kept on that sort of positive relationship with movement too. So
what was our guy who did the mind memory recall game?
Yeah, that was Ben. So he's he's incredible.
The most lovely person ever, who had been like a memory recall kind of champion in the 90s. And as like returning back to, you know,
big comeback.
Yeah, big comeback, and was kind of engaging with movement. He's like for the first time in his life ever. And it's pretty hilarious about it, bless him.
It was, and it was just like great. He came, and I was there on his sort of first day, and he'd never owned a pair of trainers. He was in his mid sort of 40s, and you know, he was very dismissive that physical activity, you know, could have any benefit for him whatsoever. He came on plimsolls for the, you know, first session, and yeah, he was a memory champion, incredibly remarkable guy. I mean, one of the things that he held the world record for was memorizing the order of a 52 pack of cards nine times for nine packs. Wow. in a go. And he could remember, you know, the quickest time also to world record for memorizing a pack of cards in, I don't think it was like under 30 seconds. He could just memorize it. And it's just like unbelievable brain power and function, way beyond what I can do. And sometimes it's just a case of turning on the laptop and where have I put this document and that kind of thing. And he did remarkable, and he sort of really fell in love with, you know, movement and walking. It was so nice, and he got some great benefits. I won't ruin too much if anyone wants to watch it.
No, don't, because I feel like I got like probably 70% the way through, so I actually don't. I feel like I need to go and watch the conclusion just to see, because I think he was particularly lovely, and I feel like with him, where exercise has only been marketed about kind of aesthetics and weight, I felt like that's where he kind of slipped through the cracks, because he's like, well, I don't care about that. That is not a value to me. I'm interested in my passions, and you know, these sort of memory games and whatever it is, his other interests. And he wasn't interested in that. So like, well, I'm not going to do this. I don't think there's really any benefit, because I don't really care about that. And I think there are a lot of people out there who have also slipped through the cracks and have gone, oh, this isn't for me. So, you know, why would I go and run? I don't care, you know, I don't care, you know, so much about like looking a certain way in swimming trunks on holiday. I'll just carry on doing nothing, because it clearly has to be really hard and painful, and I don't want to do that. Whereas he found kind of power walking, I think, was his thing.
It was.
And yeah, he ended up like quite enjoying it and go, actually, I'm quite pleasantly surprised. This is quite fun.
He did. He was really pleased, because he found that he was just improving his performance of what was important to him. You know, and that was just really nice to sort of see. And I think, you know, we've exercise and movement and activity has been sold so short, so short, by saying, you know, you can look a certain way or change how you feel in X amount of time. It's really difficult for all people to do that, and that's not sustainable. And, you know, how short-sighted to say that the benefits of movement are just to how we look. I mean, just it's just so short-sighted and false, really, because it's very difficult to change, you know, body size, body perception through movement. It's not really its intended, you know, purpose anyway. It's to make this lifelong relationship to just sort of make us feel better. And, you know, with sort of body, you know, image, size, or anything, you know, when you talk to people who are getting a certain way, when's enough enough? You know, it's never enough. Mm-hmm. Enough is enough for many people, and say, I'm really happy now. I'm just going to sort of carry on with my lovely sort of routine I've got now. If that's your primary determining factor, not many people are happy with that long term. But if we get around to, how does it make you feel? Do you feel happier? Do you feel healthier? Then, you know, it's much more sustainable for the long term, and it's much more immediate too. Is, you know, like you said, you did your you know, dance earlier on today. You felt great.
Felt amazing.
I mean, if you just kept going for, you know, a certain look or a certain change, you know, you'd give up after a short period of time, because it just takes time. It's very difficult.
I've taught a million classes in my career, and I have seen people and, you know, work with people who I think have kind of done a class. I've taught a lot of spin classes specifically, and in spin you'll see they'll have like an amazing time, and then they'll kind of look down at their watch and go like, oh, I thought I burnt more calories than that. Oh, and you can tell that they felt great, and, you know, if they were just present in the moment, they loved it. But then they look at their watch, they kind of look at this data, and they go like, oh, well, actually it wasn't very good then, or it wasn't. And I get so frustrated, I want to shake them and be like, your body's getting benefits whether your watch has a certain number on it or not. Your brain and your body have benefited from you doing that movement. And actually, it's such a shame that because we rely on a lot of external data to kind of validate what we're doing, often we forget to actually tap in and connect to how it actually feels when you're in your body in the moment. Because you can feel it right then and there, I think.
Of course you can. And you know, that feeling that you get, you know, is you know, almost immediate. And then you get sort of relaxation typically after. I mean, you know, not many things that you do sort of really give you that. And it's just so important to sort of be there, be present and appreciate that. And it doesn't need to be, you know, a really long period of time or anything else, you know, in terms of, you know, really intense, just doing, you know, something and just know that you're having a really positive impact on your mind and also your brain. And not many things can have such a positive impact, you know, on those vital, you know, organs, you know, within us. And really the sort of brain and the mind is so unique. You know, we can replace, if we need to, like a, I don't know, a finger or an arm or a leg, you know, even a heart, for instance. You know, we can you know, exercise or movement can help all of these things, but when it comes to looking after our brain and our mind and how we feel, you know, we can't have a brain transplant, but we, you know, we can sort of have these immediate positive impacts on these by, you know, enjoying movement.
Brendan, this has been such a fantastic conversation. And before we kind of get into the end of it, I want to just have a little bit of a, not a disclaimer, but just have maybe a few pointers from you on what sources we should be trusting when we're learning about, you know, the benefits of movement, and, you know, what might be red flags in some of these conversations and what are green flags?
Sure. I would say a red flag for me personally is anyone who is, well, I'll reframe it, not anyone, but anything that is really saying this is the way, the solution, you know, do, you know, class X or, you know, activity type Y, because everybody's different. And we need to really, you know, acknowledge that when we're looking after mental health, this is really complex and multifaceted. And we know that, you know, movement can really help, but, you know, it's not the primary solution for all people, just like medication is not, just like talking therapy is not. So, you know, anyone that's sort of already, you know, offering that's just this is the way, don't try anything else, then just sort of be careful for that. And you know, I think anything that's, you know, pushing you really hard, and I mean there's a small subset of people that will like that, but really it's to be enjoyed, and enjoyment can mean different things to different people. Some people may really enjoy going really hard and fast, and fantastic, go for it, but most people won't. And we need to make it more accessible for all people. And Agreed. This is not to be exclusive for people of a certain fitness level or people who can do a certain length of time. So, you know, it's really, really, you know, important that we do that. We just need to be much more inclusive around, you know, all people that can take part, and knowing that all movement is really important. And I think another area that's really important, we've started to sort of research and understand, you know, we've touched upon this a little bit, is I don't particularly like the term, but this is the term in the literature at the moment, is, you know, exercise addiction in the absence of an eating disorder. So we know that, you know, if you look at anorexia nervosa, for instance, is it's or bulimia, that it's quite common for people who have, you know, who very sort of, you know, exercise is very, very important to them to a detriment. And I think we just, you know, in the absence of an eating disorder, you know, we're aware that there is this group, a subset of people who are, you know, feel a compulsion to continue to, you know, engage in movement and activity, you know, even when, you know, it'd be much more beneficial for them to rest. They may have an injury and feel a need to go. It's impacting their social life, for instance. It's impacting their, you know, wanting to sort of go out, and they feel, you know, quite unhappy if they don't go and exercise or, you know, do activity.
I passed myself in that at one point in my life.
Yeah, me too. And you know, I think, you know, and there may be some people, if you go into a certain class or a certain, you know, gym or a certain other facility, that you see some people are, no matter what time you go, they're you know, this people, they're always there.
Yes.
And something is generally, without being stigmatizing or anything, you know, something is going on, for, you know, for those people. And I think we just need to be quite careful that this is about developing sustainable, positive, and I don't really like the word positive, but sort of long-term relationships. I think this is a group that we've typically sort of neglected in terms of recognizing and almost giving people a pat on the back, and, you know, going to sort of my gym and you've got like score points of how many calories you've burnt, and people are really, you know, competitive, and I'm not sure that's helpful for, you know, for certain people. And I had a PhD student, Mike Trott, finished a couple of years looking at this area of exercise addiction, and we found sort of, you know, 10-20% of people that, you know, engage in sort of exercise may have this, then it's really quite unpleasant for people. So I think we need to be careful.
We do. I mean, I've worked in several gyms. I can think of people, just people, you know, various sort of clients and people, you know, I've worked in these spaces. I've seen these people. I recognize, you know, some of those traits in myself at points. And I think you're right that it goes on the radar. And I think especially with exercise, things get so encouraged and validated because it's only beneficial. It's only, you know, this. But, you know, it's those questions of like, are you able to take a rest day without feeling strong feelings of shame and guilt and anxiety and fear, you know? And I think often when we see a lot of kind of advice and opinions online, and I think a lot of, I mean, broadly speaking, outside that kind of subset of people, but broadly speaking, I think a lot of, I would say, disordered behaviors get very normalized within the fitness industry as a whole. And I often kind of have the question with myself, and I kind of get other people to question it, but like, if someone has a healthy relationship with food, or even with, and with exercise especially, like, is that, is able to do certain things, and I think if we frame it that way, like, that they are able to take time off, they are able to not freak out if they can't have access to a gym, they are able to go on holiday and not feel like they have to work out. And, you know, there's those things we need to just be aware of, because sadly, when you are in that space, and I've been in that space, and being the person sharing that online, you get a lot of validation from people, and they really look up to you, like you're this constant source of motivation. And yeah, it just kind of feeds this cycle, doesn't it? Because you're going through your, you know, I was in that space, you know, probably like 5, 6, 7 years ago, following people who were in a fairly, very obsessive place with exercise. So therefore, I felt like I had to be in an obsessive place with exercise. And then I'd share that I was, and someone else got that feeling. And it's just, it's so tricky. And I think that's where social media kind of contributes to all of this, doesn't it?
It does. And I just think we just need to be, yeah, just sort of careful. And I think we're just starting to sort of recognize and talk about, you know, this and a sort of duty of care, really, for our friends and, you know, other people and ourselves as well. And, you know, just the other things that I, you know, it's closely tied into some of the, you know, things around body image, you know, the stuff. And I know you do lots on sort of body image too. And yeah, and just some of the sort of activity patterns that I sort of see is it can get quite extreme quite quick for people. And I was talking to someone earlier today about doing a 200K you know, race, and I just, you know, I mean, just because, you know, you see someone else doing that, people do quite extreme things.
They do.
Yeah.
I know there's someone online at the moment who runs every day for like, I think, several years at this point. And I think that's been really, really celebrated. And as much as I, you know, I worry about that person. I worry about when I see their content, I kind of get frustrated that people aren't going like, are you okay? Why do you need to run every day? What happens if you didn't run? What would happen then? But because it's this, like, it's a streak. So then it gets a lot of external validation from, you know, hundreds of thousands of people online. So that's really hard. And I think,
imagine the pressure of stopping if you're that person. I mean,
because that's your identity now.
Do you feel? How could you stop? I mean, man, it's just going to be. And yeah, I think we've got to be, it's a very complex area in terms of the sort of psyche within everything.
It's
and
not
the support.
Like, we know what's going on with that person. No idea. I just find it interesting. I would just, you know, if I were their friend, I'd be like, you know, is everything okay? That would just be my, you know, just a check-in.
Yeah, and quite. And I think you'd have good reason to be as well. I just think, I mean, we get a broad spectrum, you know, of views online. And, you know, unfortunately, the algorithms point us in you know, to certain funnels with people, and it's just a bit of a minefield out there.
It is. This has been fantastic, Brendan. Before we go, I have to ask you, what has been your most recent train happy moments? This can be a moment of you just having fun, or maybe, I don't know, letting go of the pressures of feeling like you have to do an 8, 9, 10.
So, do you know, I've recently restarted boxing. And again, boxing's quite hard, but I've been going back to...
You've got the boxing gloves on the screen behind you.
There you go. So, and I've been working on like footwork, and it's a bit like dancing, and
yes.
It's kind of something in terms of like dancing and coordinated movements. I'm a bit dyspraxic, not very good at coordinated movements. So I'm kind of like, oh, I can't do it. So I've just been really enjoying letting the ego go in like a gym with other people and just practicing like really quite basic footwork and dancing in this context of boxing and just not caring and just throwing myself into it. And I mean, it's not hard or high intense work, and it's quite menial, but I've just been enjoying sort of dancing and just getting stuff wrong and just learning and just saying that's fine. So I'm enjoying dancing and in the context of boxing at the moment.
Float like a butterfly, sting like a bee.
There you go.
That's Dr. Brendan.
Well, I was going to call out someone. So
oh, yeah.
I was going to call out for a fight, Jake Paul, but...
Oh, okay. Jake Paul, if you're listening, we've got already a fighter ready. Would you actually compete? Do you want to fight?
If Jake Paul was up for it, I'll go for it. Yeah, why not?
You can make some good money off of that.
Why not?
This has been brilliant. So, Brendan, where can people find you, find your work, find Mind Games, for example? Where can they, see what you're doing?
Sure. So Mind Games, The Experiment, it's available on Amazon Prime. So type it in, have a look. And I'm on Instagram. I'm not very good at it, but Brendon Stubbs, you can find me on there. That's the main point. And if you search hard enough, you can find my email and drop me an email.
Amazing. This has been so, so helpful. I think people are going to feel really encouraged and are hopefully excited about all the incredible benefits that movement has on their mental health. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
But that is it for this week's episode of the Train Happy podcast. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you took something away from this episode. And if you did, please do let us know on social media. You can find us on Instagram at Train Happy Podcast. And we do want to hear from you. We want your questions. We want to hear your Train Happy moments. And we'd love to feature you as Train Happy Trooper of the Week. So remember, you can get in touch with us via our WhatsApp. It is 07599 927 537. And whatever podcast platform you're choosing to listen to us on, please rate and review. It really helps the show and it really helps spread the Train Happy message. And that is it for this week. I'll be back with a brand new episode for you next Monday. See you then.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.